it. This is Paul Roland with Wednesday Talk Radio. Thank you for board opping, Sonia, and thanks to the staff of KBOO. And once again, we do survive and thrive on your donations as a listener-sponsored community radio station. And if you haven't supported us recently or want to increase your support, go to kboo.fm and click on donate. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Tribes aren't just getting these things for nothing. They got these things because they gave up the United States. That's what they gave up. And that's what the federal court said. That's why they don't pay federal taxes. Tribes do not pay federal taxes because they were sued on all that. And the court said, no, no, they paid their taxes for all time.
Welcome to Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon. We feature interviews with leaders in the community focusing on issues important to Washington County.
Welcome to Inside Washington County. I'm Rob Solomon. Today we have Congresswoman Elizabeth Furst as our guest. Elizabeth Furst is a former member of the United States Congress from Oregon's 1st District. Having served three terms from 1992 to 1998. Since 1998, she has worked with national tribal leaders to establish the Institute for Tribal Government in the Mark O. Hatfield School of Government at Portland State University. She was also a co-founder of the National Coalition to Support Indian Treaties from 70 to 78, was director of the Tribal Restoration Project for the Native American Program at Oregon Legal Services, 80 to 86, and was the founder and director of the Oregon Peace Institute from 1986 to 1991. Welcome, Congresswoman.
Thank you.
Thank you. Moving straight into some questions today, we're concerned about the lack of awareness of Native American issues, and with greatest respect for your work over all these years, perhaps you could begin by explaining to our listeners broadly the tribal situation in Oregon. I'm thinking, who are the major tribes in the Northwest, in Northwest Oregon, Southwest Washington? What's the climate?
Well, the basic thing that I find people don't know is about the treaties. The United States Constitution, Article 6, says treaties are the supreme law of the land, and all our judges are to be bound by them, state law notwithstanding. That means that a state cannot pass a law that interferes with a treaty right. The United States decided fairly soon that they'd better start making treaties with tribes because of land. The United States was interested in getting title to land, and new settlers were coming in and would meet an Indian in the woods and would say, oh, I'd like to buy this piece of land. And the Indian would say, sure, you know. Of course, no legality to it.
No concept of ownership.
No. Well, they knew they owned it, and they knew but individuals did not own.
So I see.
Across the nation, particularly in the West, there were little problems where somebody else would come on that piece of land, and then there'd be a fight, and then somebody would get killed, and the army would be called in. And this went on all over the country. So the United States decided pretty early that they needed to make treaties. And the main thing that the United States wanted was title to the land. They also thought about it, the U.S. did. What about another nation comes on and there's no title to this land? They just move on. So say Spain now wants to come into the United States. We have no legal title to the land. And you have to transfer title from Aboriginal to the new. So the United States Constitution sets up treaties. Now, treaties are very specific. They can only be signed by two sovereigns. In the United States Constitution, it says states may not sign treaties, which means that tribes were more sovereign than states.
What exactly does sovereignty, what does sovereignty mean?
It means control over lands and people. And a lot of people think that the United States has given a lot of things to tribes. Mm-hmm. But courts have said the rights of property and sovereignty were not granted by the United States, that instead they were inherent to their background, to their history. And so they were not something the United States gave. Oh, you're sovereign. No, they always were sovereign. So therefore, the United States had to deal with them mm-hmm. by treaty, internationally recognized way of dealing.
How did they do in dealing with the tribes in our area in the Pacific Northwest?
Governor Stevens was sent to be the treaty maker. He did Washington and he was appointed as a treaty maker. Mm-hmm. And he went, they called the tribes together, they got groups, and what did they offer the tribes? Well, what they offered the tribes was protection. Didn't always work out that way, but that was the offer. So the tribes would get protection from the United States because they were being encroached by all these visitors who were taking things. And the United States would get the land transfer. About 90 to 99 million acres were transferred through tribes.
But then the obvious question is, if they took over the land and in return gave the Native Americans protection, mm-hmm. where did they provide that protection for those Native Americans?
Well, if something occurred from non-Indians or non-treaty people, and then the United States Army supposedly would be brought in to protect tribal rights.
No, I understand that, but I guess I'm getting that they must have moved the tribes if they're taking the land.
No, they didn't take all the land.
Okay.
What they did is the tribes would reserve in the treaty certain mm-hmm. lands. That later on became reservations.
Sure.
And they were encroached upon. It wasn't, you know, the tribes didn't always know how much they were giving, but that was the deal.
Great. Shrink your territory.
That's right.
And you'll get protection.
And we'll give you protection.
I understand.
Now, included with that were very, very specific rights. The right to take fish at usual and accustomed grounds. The right to take certain fishing, hunting rights. And those were the rights that were encroached upon.
How? I mean, if I listen to you, and from my own reading, my own basic understanding, those rights were there, just as you say, they weren't granted by the U.S., so how could the U.S. legally take them away?
Well, that's the thing. Congress has plenary power over the United States, and particularly over tribes. Mm-hmm. So plenary power means that you can come in over everything. Unfortunately, the Congress has been very, they're one minute they're, very much for tribal self-determination, and then the next minute they're passing laws that terminate tribes. So it's not been a very easy relationship. So what happens if the state of Oregon passes laws that says you can't take fish in anything but hook and rod?
Okay, no nets or things like that.
Mm-hmm. Now, the tribes always have taken fish by net, and they petitioned and pushed on the United States government to protect this treaty right, which was that they should take fish in their usual and accustomed grounds. Nothing was said about how they took it. Well, interestingly enough, the case that becomes the U.S. Supreme Court case that protects treaty rights, is not named the Quinault Tribe versus the state of Washington. It's named United States versus the state of Washington.
Ah, okay.
The United States becomes the plaintiff because their treaty had been violated by the state of Washington.
So they're more the victims than the Native American tribe.
Well, they were. It was not something that they all, that the United States said, "Oh goodness, things are happening. Oh, that's terrible." It's the tribes
that the tribes initiated, but they're represented by the government
yes.
of the United States.
And because it's a U.S. versus Washington case, it goes to the Supreme Court. And U.S. v. Washington and then later U.S. v. Oregon came. And those are the cases where the Supreme Court clearly tells of the power of the treaty.
As the Supreme Court is put in a position to make those kind of adjudications, are there any state or local departments that get involved in these disputes? I'm thinking, you know, salmon example, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife might be consulted. I'm just wondering how the state and perhaps even some municipal governments
right.
might be involved.
Well, because it's a treaty issue, it's clearly federal.
Are there amicus briefs?
Oh, yes.
Pardon me?
Oh, yes. The states become involved, but the treaty is so clear. And in the state of Washington, they passed a law that said you could only take fish on a hook and line. That was a clear violation of the treaty, which doesn't say anything about how they have the usual and accustomed ground. So, yes, states have fought vigorously against tribal issues. But all tribal issues go to the federal courts. And then in 1924, the United States Congress passed an act called the Indian Citizens and Rights Citizen Act, in which it kindly granted citizenship to all Indians who prior to that had no voting rights. And I've always thought it so funny that, you know, giving citizenship to the original people is a bit rude, but anyway, it's worked, it's been good, it's good, granted citizenship. But it is the Congress who have the plenary power over tribes. They've had a very shifting relationship, and the thing that affected Oregon the most was the law, the Termination Act of 1935. Termination was the worst act passed by the Congress to destroy tribal rights. It picked certain tribes, for instance, in Oregon, Governor McKay, great friend of the then president, became Secretary of the Interior. Well, Interior has huge jurisdiction over tribal issues. He became Secretary of the Interior, and he helped push the Termination Act. Certain tribes were named that their federal relationship would be terminated. Now, the federal relationship is the most important relationship a tribe has. And so Mr. McKay, Governor McKay, who then was Secretary of the Interior, the first tribe they really wanted to terminate was the Klamath Tribe because they had a huge timber resource. And they terminated them, no consent from the tribe. They received no benefits from the United States prior to. They were just a recognized tribe that had a treaty. Termination ended all federal benefits to a tribe, which threw those benefits on the state. Suddenly, here are all these people who have been eligible for benefits, education, health, those sorts of things, were removed. A meeting down in Klamath Falls. And the United States then had control over all those lands and timber. About 80% of the timber was sold, cut, sent to, most went to Japan. And they had the largest herd of white-tailed deer and mule deer too. And those disappeared because the changes. Tribal people who had always had their homes on the reservation, they'd had education on the all that ended. It was a devastating act. And now, they have been restored. They were restored by an act of Congress. It required an act of Congress to restore them.
Is this pretty much a model of the way over the last 100 years that the U.S. government has negotiated with the various tribes?
Well, treaty mating ended by an act of Congress in 1871. There were no more treaties after 1871. But by then, most of the treaties had been signed. Almost every tribe had a treaty. And then when those were terminated, as Oregon was the hardest hit by termination, and We don't have a reservation in Washington County, but there certainly were the Falafelis were here, the Tualatis were here. We have a place where you can see the treaty-making trees. Well, there was a little group of these oaks, and I think all but three have fallen down, but anyway, it's a very historic place.
Sure.
So there was treaty making. Termination ended that. And then now all but two of the terminated tribes in Oregon have been restored by a federal act of restoration.
With that restoration, they get their protection back.
Yes, but they don't necessarily get a reservation back. That has been very hard for tribes to get.
So we must have some tribes without any home.
Yes, in a way, that's true. Now, the Grand Ronde's 39 tribes, mm-hmm. a part of their tribe, they were terminated, then restored. And those were people who had been marched up from southern Oregon in a trail of tears. Half of the people died on the trip. They weren't allowed to stop and bury their people. And the excuse for marching them up the road was gold was discovered in the rivers down in by Eugene. There was suddenly gold. And gold seekers came up from California. And they, and of course the tribes were on the river, so they always are,
mm-hmm.
and the gold seekers began to shoot them. They called themselves the exterminators.
Oh my.
Now the United States said, oh, we can't have this happening, but we'll round up all the Indians and march them away from, instead of getting rid of the exterminators, and that's what was what happened. They were marched from Southern Oregon up and made put onto what was then determined as the Grand Ronde Reservation.
Wow, what a history.
Oh, it's a dreadful history.
What about when it comes to disputes between tribes? Mm-hmm. Are those disputes arbitrated by the federal government, or would the state get involved at that level?
No, the federal government would have to be involved in it. The state is not recognized really as having any jurisdiction. By law, the state cannot come on a reservation without express permission from the Congress.
And the federal government, can they go on to any reservation
yes.
without the permission of the...
It would be unlikely because of keeping good relationships.
In other words, being diplomatic.
Yeah. Bureau of Indian Affairs has a representative on every reservation. And we have a Bureau of Indian Affairs office in Portland.
What about in terms of residential and commercial salmon fishing here in Oregon waterways? Have enough accommodations been made for tribal communities who depend on salmon for both economic and spiritual purposes?
No. Now, the U.S. v. Oregon case, which was in the 70s, the U.S. v. Oregon case said tribes have the right to 50%, it says, in common in the treaty. That 50% is then measured against what's the run going to be that year? Mm. Tribes have the right to commercial, to religious, and to spiritual, like if you're doing a feast.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very complicated, and it's constantly disputed who gets what. But they have the right to 50%. That means, really, 50% have to be caught by tribal people. And it's always a muddle, always a push. That's why the state becomes very involved with state fishing rights.
May I assume that that's a minimum of 50% to be caught by the native tribes?
No, it's if you know that 300 fish are coming in the river, 150 are reserved.
And if you happen to catch 151, that tribe, do you have to return it? I'm sorry to
yeah.
be so specific, but I'm just trying to get how specific the regulations
well,
are.
Well, the regulations are very specific, and so the tribes are constantly aware of what they're fishing. There's always, almost always, a person on the river who says, stop. And there was a very famous gentleman from Warm Springs who was the man who said, that's it. And then the nets would be taken out of the river. I mean, they're the biggest protectors of the salmon runs, the tribes.
Excellent, that protection is needed. And I'm
yeah.
not saying that just because I'm desperately in love with salmon. I have yeah. a great deal of respect for the relationship between
oh, yeah.
salmon and
oh,
the
yeah.
tribal folks. Moving to a completely different area, there are folks of color in our community in Washington County, 25% to 30%, and many of them are visible. In my own perception, the issues among Native Americans in our county and even in our the greater Portland area don't seem to be as visible as some of the other minorities. I'm just wondering, but from the tribal members and other Native Americans you've gotten to know, how strongly does tribal identity influence the typical Oregon Native Oregonian Native American?
Oh, I think it's very strong, and it's familial. So that's a real difference. They know who they are, they know who their family are. They're very close. Now, one of the reasons there's not much of, as you might find in another county, is there's not a tribe in this county. But all the tribes have lawyers. They all are very on to what's happening to their rights. And they have excellent lawyers. And a Native American program of Oregon Legal Services that I worked for, I coordinated the restoration efforts for the terminated tribes in Oregon.
Excellent. Moving more to an individual level of Native Americans dealing with urban being pushed into urban areas, urbanization, etc., what prominent inequities do Native American descendants, or former tribal members too, face in the Portland metro area?
Well, I can't really answer that. First of all, I'm not a tribal member, and I stay away from talking about family things. But I think what you have in the Washington County, Portland area, is you have people who know how to deal with the cases, the law. There are many very good organizations in Portland. And then you have the tribes with their tribal attorneys who are constantly looking out for those rights. Those rights are completely vital to every tribe.
Certainly.
Those treaty rights. And it's only the tribes. I was in Washington State during the U.S. v. Washington thing, and it was the tribes insisting in being in demonstrations to get the United States to pay attention, because in Washington State, the state was really restricting tribal fishing. This whole business of it has to be on a hook and line is absolutely ridiculous, because that's not how the tribes fish.
I get the impression that perhaps one of the largest tasks for the attorneys working on behalf of the tribes is, in fact, to get the federal government's attention.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Although we have a very, in this state, we have a very active Bureau of Indian Affairs who are very up on the law. They are very good communicators with the tribes. There are 10 federally recognized tribes in Oregon.
Okay. Portland has the 9th largest population of Native Americans in our country, as approximated by Multnomah County. That's where we got the data. What historically contributes to Portland's relatively high density of natives?
Termination.
Got it. When they were moved out, this is where
they had
came.
To find somewhere to live, and they began to build there. Yes, termination. There was also an act of Congress which sent people, paid tribal members, to go to San Francisco to learn typing or
some sort of vocational training.
Yes, and that actually, a lot of people were caught up in that. And so you'll see that in San Francisco. But Portland, it's termination.
When they were sent for vocational training, it just struck me. Do you think that helped the tribes to stay together, or did that push tribes more apart?
Stay together.
Good. Okay. Excellent. I wonder about
that. I mean, and it wasn't easy for them to stay together, but they did.
No, because yeah. I would think that as they're in classes with other folks,
that's
they would
right.
be
travel.
A great pressure to assimilate.
Yeah. Yeah.
And assimilation at the cost of their culture. I'm going to make an assumption in this question, and please challenge it if it's incorrect. From your perspective, how have officials in the Portland metro area, or even the state of Oregon, attempted to address the disproportionate levels of poverty, unemployment, and other socioeconomic barriers in Native communities?
Well, I think it's been a spotty history. I think almost any time you see the tribes benefiting, it's because the tribal people have pressured to get what is their due. Now, we're a country that has incredible poverty. an incredible difference between rich and poor. So for tribal people, one of the things I would imagine is the hardest is if you're moved out of your community and into an urban community. But you'd have to ask people who've done that, who've gone to schools outside their communities.
Understood.
Family is so important.
From your perspective, Congresswoman, what are the most essential changes or programs that need to be made in order to best serve the Native Americans that have now become either voluntarily or involuntarily urban Native Americans?
Well, I think Oregon made a big step last year by saying that we need, in the schools, there need to be a basic education on, and it should be written by the tribes. And it is beginning to get into schools. Education, as far as I'm concerned, is the one issue that needs to somehow be absorbed by ordinary people that mm-hmm. says, no, tribes aren't just getting these things for nothing. They got these things because they gave up the United States. That's what they gave up. And that's what the federal court said. That's why they don't pay federal taxes. Tribes do not pay federal taxes because they were sued on all that. And the court said, no, they paid their taxes for all time.
So we really have made some advances more recently in recent history. It actually sounds as though the United States government is letting go some of its paternalistic attitudes.
Well, I really worry about this administration. I worry that there is going to be a pullback. You see, in 1972, the Congress passed the National Indian Gaming Act, which has been a huge difference. It has put tribal money in their hands. It can only be used on the reservation. I was at a hearing, personally, as a congresswoman, and Mr. Trump, a witness, and he said, and I've had casinos for 50 years, he said. This is ridiculous. He said, they don't even look like Indians. And I said to the chairman, may I ask a question? I said, Mr. Trump, do you know that there's scientific evidence that shows tribes have been gaming for over 500 years? And the man picked up his papers and he left the hearing room. I've never seen a witness leave the hearing room.
I can't imagine how many people out there envy you to have asked Mr. Trump a question and have him leave in response.
Yes.
Oh, what a moment.
Absolutely. But that is the mindset. Why do these people, quote unquote, get this? Well, nobody knows because there was a constitution which says these things are going to happen.
Well, it's interesting we're talking about Mr. Trump and the Constitution in the same paragraph because there are other issues right now, but it seems as though he's had a relationship of difficulty with constitutional aspects for quite some time.
Well, I was very concerned about what would happen with the Department of Interior mm-hmm. because that is the agency that, well, we've seen who was appointed to the Department of Interior, and I'm just worried about that. I think that's going to be a constant irritation. I think if he gets elected, and I shouldn't be saying this, I don't know this, but if he gets elected, I would look at the tribal casinos as being in some
trouble.
Jeopardy.
Yeah, understood. Are you still actively involved in consulting and helping different tribes?
Yes, I've been on a number of boards. I serve on, well, not now. I'm not on any board right now, but Warm Springs and Grand Ronde. And I'm in touch with a lot of the folks. The tribes are always looking out for their friends. I mean, mm-hmm. they want to, if they know that somebody's been, I've been active for 45 years, so, I'm not a newcomer to it. There was a case in Yakima when the Yakimas signed their, when they came together to do the treaty, and Governor Stevens went up there, and the Yakima chiefs got together and they said no, they didn't want to sign a treaty. They had heard from other tribes that they hadn't been the best things for them. Yakima's a huge tribe and very dominant. And Governor Stevens said to the chiefs, he said, well, let me just ask General somebody or other, who will tell you what will happen if you don't sign the treaty. Now, coming from an idea of, willing seller, willing buyer,
mm-hmm.
and this general said to the Yakima chiefs, well, here's what will happen. If you don't sign a treaty, the non-Indians will start to come in and take your land. And you'll fight with them, and you'll kill some of them. And if you do, the U.S. Army will come in, and the rivers will run red with your blood. And the chiefs agreed to sign. See, there's so much power on one side. And yet, what the tribes had was something the U.S. had to have. They had to have title to the land.
Well, and it's a shame that those folks don't have much of a sense of the history of their own nation or region.
Or their own laws.
And I think we owe the founding people, not just founding fathers, we hear that all the time, but the founding people of this nation, of this country, of these lands, I think we owe them a great deal, both past and present. But we also owe you a great deal for sharing your time today.
Oh, no, not at all.
I'm very, very grateful for the work that you do, the work that you've done, the work that you've shared with us today. Thank you very, very much. And I want to thank Shauna Muckle, our intern, for some excellent research. And don't forget to give us some feedback on our website, insidewashco.org.
Thank you for listening to Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon. Go to our website, insidewashco.org, to contact us or leave comments on this interview. This series is produced by Rick Paulson.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a global audience, produced at a different location every week. Today on Sprouts, the influence of George Floyd, two events that have happened off the beaten track of the mainstream protests. First, in Minneapolis, the transformation of a Sheraton hotel into a sanctuary for the homeless. Second, solidarity